Hello, welcome to another episode of Pining for Pixels. I'm your host, Red Rooster, and today we're going to be doing a Crowing from the Perch episode, and the topic this week will be review culture. So something I've actually wanted to talk to for a little while, and it's kind of coming to a head for this year, and we'll get into it in a little bit. But first, let's look at some of the news that's been going on. As I talked about last week, Valve had made an unexpected announcement about the Steam Deck OLED, which was basically revealed and reviews were immediately released because a lot of press outlets had copies of the new device and had put out their impressions, and it was largely very positive impressions. And it's out now. It launched on the 16th, and it has... surprisingly, like, it didn't sell out right away, and I thought, oh, maybe people aren't as interested, but it sounds like indeed there's a lot of interest in it. It's just that Steam has been planning this for a while, has been piling up their warehouse with units to sell, and as well, and I know they have the standard unit as well as a limited edition unit that has a nice translucent plastic on it and these very nifty orange color schemes. On like the thumbsticks, the stems of the thumbsticks are orange, the heat vents are orange, and the power button is orange, which is, again, just that's the limited edition version, which costs a bit, I think, $30 or so more, but it looks really nice. Anyhow, it I think just for that particular version, or it could be for the whole thing, but they limited the amount of or how you could buy these Steam Decks. So the Steam Deck OLED itself is available worldwide, but I think the limited edition is only available to United States and Canada. And the only way to purchase one of them is if you have a Steam account in good standing, in that you have made a purchase prior to November of 2023 on. This is a way to combat piracy, because, you know, obviously, if this is limited edition, lots of people are going to be wanting to fly in and get it and then flip it on the secondhand market for a hot price. And I think this was an ingenious way to cover it. I mean, obviously, Valve has the platform in order to do this by making sure that anyone who's buying it has a Steam account that has had purchases registered on it prior to November, because obviously, if they didn't have that little caveat of having to had purchases prior to November, you would probably have a lot of fake accounts getting made, making a minor purchase on Steam just in order to buy the limited edition console as quick as possible and then flip it. So anyway, they're still in stock if you're thinking of picking one up. I mean, they're a bit pricey, but if you are thinking about it, the Steam Deck is definitely very well supported and a very solid piece of hardware. And obviously, yeah, if you have a Steam library, then there you go. That's your library for your system. You're already set there. So it's pretty awesome. Anyhow, it's gotten good reviews. And I guess the OLED screen is really huge, and their battery life has significantly increased over the previous unit. Okay, and then another piece of news. This actually got announced and happened the same day that my last episode posted last week, and that was on November 14th. Nintendo announced that they were going to have an Indie World Direct, and indeed they did. Later on that day, they ran through a number of upcoming indie games, and there was a couple shadow drops, but to be quite honest, there really wasn't anything of note, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to any of the games that were shown. There's a couple I thought looked interesting, but I at this point I can't even remember. But I just remember thinking it was one of the more underwhelming ones. But one thing I wanted to bring up is that a big missing piece here, it's not, anytime an Indie World is announced or even just a straight up Nintendo Direct, a lot of people wonder, oh, is Hollow Knight Silksong going to show up at this one? And the answer so far, including this time, has always been no. So still not a word about it. You know, I know they've previously given updates about how it's coming along, and I don't think it's a huge team necessarily, although, to be honest, I don't know. But I kind of think at this point, they're kind of in a spot where, people aren't, well, I shouldn't say people aren't, because I think once it finally comes out, it'll do well. But there's a lot of hype and anxiety built up around this game that there's no way they're going to be able to live up to what everyone wants. But I think they've kind of surpassed that point where it's kind of like when Half-Life 3, which never came out, was anticipated. There was sort of a time where it was, there was a, like all-time high in terms of hype for it, and then it just never came out. Now, obviously, you know, we're way past that point. And if they were to release it today, I think people would be excited. But would it live up to those, to what was expected or to what was thought of? Probably not. So I don't know. I kind of think we'd be maybe in a situation like that at this point with Silksong. If it's not coming out anytime soon, that we would be at a situation where maybe it's not going to live up to people's expectation anymore, or possibly some people have just simply moved on since then and would just later on find out, oh, hey, by the way, Silksong came out. Oh, cool, I'll check it out. Versus at the time coming out while the iron is hot. But I mean, hey, I'm not a developer. I don't know what it's like to try and get this kind of stuff done, and definitely trying to live up to the original Hollow Knight, which was amazing. I mean, I know for sure if they announced Silksong coming out tomorrow, I'd be all over that. I loved the first Hollow Knight. So as soon as that one comes out, I'll be all for it. But I do definitely kind of get like a little bit of a fatigue, anticipation fatigue, I guess. So by the time it comes out, you know, I mean, whatever, it's not like it's owed, but you know, by the time it comes out, I guess it's just no longer sort of in the zeitgeist, I guess, right? And since that was kind of how they were angling things, but I don't know, we'll see, because I'm sure it'll be good, and it will do well, because obviously Hollow Knight is no small thing anymore. But anyhow, another big Nintendo bit of news that dropped as well was the live-action Legend of Zelda movie that got announced by Nintendo from a tweet from, apparently from Shigeru Miyamoto, confirming that they are going to be filming and releasing a Legend of Zelda movie. But unlike the Mario movie, this is going to be a live-action film, which seems to have had a bit of a mixed reaction amongst people. So I'm just looking online right now about Legend of Zelda movie. I see places like IGN with a why the Legend of Zelda movie shouldn't be live action. Oh no, it shouldn't be. Oh no. So it's unfortunate to see these kinds of reactions, because so they announced that the director is going to be Wes Ball, and Wes Ball is the director who had done the Maze Runner movies. I've never seen them. And the upcoming, oh God, he has a movie coming up shortly. I can't remember what it is, but there's a lot of suspicion about, is he going to be the right guy to do it? Because, you know, Avi Arad was the one who's going to be the producer, and he's kind of done, he's had some hits and misses in his past, but I don't know. The thing is, for me, I'm like, well, we haven't seen anything. We didn't see a trailer that looked weird or wonky. You know, and we see that there was a lot of people concerned about who were they going to cast for this. But, I mean, given how Mario turned out, right now, because we know nothing more other than the director, producer, and the fact that it's happening and it's going to be live action, it's not worth getting upset about. It's not worth being pre-disappointed, which kind of seems to be what a lot of people are doing. There's a lot of sort of pre-disappointment about this announcement. It's just something to be excited about. I mean, until you see a trailer or you know, something that looks weird, but, you know, we know nothing about it other than just the fact that it's going to exist. So don't get worried about it. It's I personally trust that Nintendo's going to do that, because, you know, when the original Super Mario movie was announced and the cast was announced, Chris Pratt as Mario got a lot of groans from people, a lot of people who were so upset and blah, 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 blah. Why not Charles Martinet and blah, 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 all sorts of trouble. But at the end of the day, oh, he actually did a great job. Now you don't hear anyone batting an eye about that. A couple little jokes about it every once in a while, but mostly everyone kind of thought he did a good job. So in this case, you know, I'll think of a couple other film related things. like when Christopher Nolan did Batman Begins, and then he was going to do the sequel, The Dark Knight. It's going to feature the Joker, and then it was announced Heath Ledger would play the Joker, and a lot of it, oh my gosh, oh, that's awful. And it turns out Heath Ledger, I mean, unfortunately, was his final role, but he also was the basically the quintessential Joker. He did an amazing job there, right? And then another very, very prominent similar situation was when it was announced that New Line Cinema would be releasing The Lord of the Rings adapted into three films from director Peter Jackson, whose previous filmography had been some very low budget and low brow sort of horror films and stuff that didn't really seem like he would be the right fit for it. But they put their faith in him. They gave him all three, and here it was happening, live action films, and a lot of concern with that, and look what we got with that, right? Those were incredible movies. So anyway, I'm just making a point. This is not a movie podcast, but just making a point that The Legend of Zelda, it's way too early to be quote-unquote concerned, upset, or, you know, offering the critique to the filmmakers and having all these doubts. I mean, sure, maybe if you're a negative person in general, or, you know, whatever, for whatever reason you have those concerns, fine. But, I mean, I don't know. You know, I'd like to just, I personally trust they're going to do something good, and I'll wait to see when there's a trailer a couple years down the road, basically. But anyway, that's it. It's big news, and it's exciting. There's going to be a Legend of Zelda movie. Very good. One thing I also note, too, is I saw a lot of people speculating which story they're going to do. Maybe Ocarina of Time, maybe Twilight Princess, blah, 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 blah. They're not going to do any of the games. I guarantee it. It'll be its own story, probably taking elements from plenty of different games. But I suspect it would be its own unique storyline. But we'll see. It is coming up at some point in the next several years, I guess. All right, so another big announcement, which just dropped on Friday, is the announcement of, and this is for PlayStation, The Last of Us Part 2 Remastered. This had leaked beforehand, so we already knew this was coming. There was no doubt about it. And here it is. It's now officially announced. It's coming out, I think, January 19th, some point in January. So this is going to be The Last of Us Part 2 Remastered. It's going to be a native version of Last of Us Part 2 that runs on the PS5, not through backwards compatibility. So it's interesting because Last of Us Part 2 running on the PS5 via backwards compatibility with the PS4 version already looks amazing, and it really kind of looks like a PlayStation 5 game. So I remember early on in the PS5's life cycle, a lot of questions about, well, you know, probably they're going to do a native version of it, but is there really any value in it? It already kind of looks like a PS5 game. How much better can they make it look? And the answer to that is not much, because they've shown some screenshots, and some of them are comparison shots, and it's like, well, they just look the same. Sometimes I'm like, I'm not sure which one's supposed to be the PS4 or which one's the PS5. I mean, that is, and that's not an insult to the PS5 version. That's really a compliment to what they were able to pull off on the PS4. But yeah, no, it looks incredible, no matter which way you cut it. Assumingly that, you know, if you're playing the backwards compatibility version, I do believe there is already 60 frames per second through backwards compatibility. So it's not even really going to have that over it. But thankfully, they're doing more than just a straight up up-res and all that stuff. So yeah, they're making some graphical tweaks. You're going to get more cutting edge visual stuff, but it's sort of diminishing returns at this point. It will technically look better than the PS4 version, but it's not going to be like a huge leaps and bounds version better, right? This is not like the Last of Us remake versus the original version that came out, or the remake which came out last year, I think. This is just, like I said, a remaster. So it looks a little bit better. But on top of the graphical updates, they are also adding content. So instead of the graphical tweaks, there's going to be developer commentary of some of the cutscenes. There's going to be a guitar free play mode. So part of the game, there's certain areas in a cutscene where you're able to play a guitar. And a lot of people really like that. So now they've added a guitar free play mode, so you can sort of go to town playing your own sort of renditions on the game. There's also some additional content from the game, like I'm talking storyline stuff, that got cut that is going to be restored, and they're referring to it as the Lost Levels. So these are just sequences that are restored into the game. But there's one really big addition that's going to be part of this, and it is a roguelike survival mode called No Return. So, and I'm going to read the way they describe it, and I quote, "Experience The Last of Us Part 2's deep combat via an entirely new mode. Survive as long as you can in each run as you choose your path through a series of randomized encounters. Play as a host of different unlockable characters, some never before playable in The Last of Us franchise, each with unique gameplay traits. The variety of challenges feature different foes and memorable locations from throughout Part 2, all culminating in tense boss battles." End quote. So, yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I'm like, okay, it sounds kind of a basic sort of survival horde mode kind of thing. But on the other hand, that's kind of cool because, I mean, The Last of Us 2 has pretty good combat. And the main thing is that the core game is primarily just this narrative story. There's not a huge amount of replay value in that. But this is a mode that sounds like it'd be a lot of fun to play through. Would really sort of support more of the game side of being video game. Being more, I'm thinking it sounds a little more arcadey. It's going to have the slick visuals of Last of Us 2. So it sounds pretty exciting. But the best thing about this, in my opinion, with all this content, I'm glad that it's not just, I mean, they're releasing it, their own special edition PS5 version with a steelbook case and the whole nine yards. But if you already have it, like most people who love Last of Us will probably already own a copy of Last of Us Part 2, whether digital or the physical version. I mean, there's a steelbook version of the PS4 release. That's the one I have. That they're not leaving you out to have to rebuy the game at full price. Although that option's available for those that want to, or for those who have never bought it before, you can also, using your PS4 version, you can pay a $10, that's US $10 upgrade fee, which is, I think Canadian's equivalent to about $13, which is great because that means for myself, I'm going to be just paying the upgrade fee. I don't have to purchase it again for a game that, you know, I've already played. It's going to be exciting to be able to play the additional content and see all the extras and stuff, but not have to pay the full price of a game. I mean, I can certainly get that, like the effort that goes into even just a straightforward remaster, you know, they like to see that sort of be rewarded. But the fact is there is more content in an entirely new mode with No Return, which sounds pretty good to me. That sounds pretty exciting. So I'm looking forward to checking that out in January, and I'll happily pay the upgrade fee for it. And yeah, that's it. That's what's coming. But I think otherwise, beyond that, in the last week, like I mentioned before, PlayStation Portal was coming out when it was released. It came out as expected on the 15th, and it is basically sold out everywhere. And I guess there's the scalpers are doing their thing, flipping these Portal consoles for super high prices. Now, if you're not familiar with the PlayStation Portal, it's not a separate portable console. It's really just a streaming device. It's got a nice, so I've been playing with it since I picked mine up. It's got this really nice screen. It's basically, you think of it, I think I saw some people suggest it like this. Think of it like a controller, basically. It's an enhanced controller with a screen in the middle of it. So you can play your PlayStation 5, stream games directly to that screen in case someone else is using TV, or like me, if you're watching a YouTube video or have a YouTube podcast or something in the background and you want to play a game as well at the same time, then it works perfectly for that. So it really is just like a DualSense controller split in half with a screen right in the middle of it. It's a nice big screen. It looks gorgeous in the full functionality of the DualSense, the haptic feedback, the adaptive triggers, all that fun stuff. So it's really cool. And in my, so from what I've understand, it's all entirely dependent on the strength of your Wi-Fi network and your internet. So I have pretty decent internet at home. My PS5 is hardwired, and I'm running a pretty good router that has a nice strong signal that I'm able to connect to on the 5 gigahertz network, and it is pretty solid connection. I've had a couple minor quibbles here and there, nothing major. To be honest, I thought it was going to be much worse. If you've done any remote access before, now I don't know if it's because I've been playing my Xbox remote play before as well, using my Backbone controller, as well as you can technically play PlayStation that way too. But I mean, I don't know if it's just me, but I kind of feel like the Portal has more solid connectivity. Like, it feels like it's all native the way I'm playing it so far. Like I said, if I'm ever downloading anything on my PlayStation at the same time as playing, then I notice some interference. But when nothing else is downloading on the PlayStation, it's fine. But yeah, so that's it. I think my impressions of the PlayStation Portal are actually positive. I thought it was going to be good, but I was actually really impressed with how good it was. And I actually ended up using it a few times throughout the week. So I would be watching a podcast and just have a game running in the background that I'm just messing around with, right? Like swinging around as Spider-Man. And that's the other thing too, the Twitch gameplay. I played some matches of Mortal Kombat 1 and Street Fighter 6. And I didn't find, I mean, again, I'm not a pro player, but I didn't find that there was any significant issue with playing like that. So I was really quite pleased with it. So yeah, there you go. If you're interested in it, know if you're happy with it being a streaming device like that, it is super beneficial. I've tried walking around my place as well to try and like vary the distance I am away from the router, and it seemed to be pretty strong all throughout. So I was really happy with it. But anyway, the other thing that I've seen a lot of hands-on about is the Blaze Entertainment Super Pockets, the Hyper Megatech product. So this is, of course, the company that does Evercade. They have this more casual line from their new label, Hyper Megatech, and they've released the Super Pocket to the Capcom and the Taito collections, and they're both have excellent collections of games, and they are solid pieces of hardware. They're really small, very easily fit into your pocket, and being able to play those games just very easily like that. The battery is pretty good. Like everything about it, it's just a solid, and it's surprisingly more solid than I expected, given the fact that these things are super cheap. I was very surprised at how solid they were, but I'm really impressed with the Super Pocket line. I think that is a great way to get people into Evercade. I mean, I already have all the Evercade carts and everything, and I have my Evercade EXP, but for someone who is maybe unsure about it and doesn't necessarily want to dive in and buy the EXP, this is a very good entry point because it's under $100, and that's even Canadian, so it's a very, very good deal, and it's super portable, so very happy with that as well. All right, so other than that, let's talk about what I've been playing lately. So in the past week, I've played a lot more RoboCop. I'm really enjoying RoboCop Rogue City. It's so good, way better than I thought it was. I mean, I didn't think it was going to be bad, but I didn't think it was going to be this good. It's been so much fun. I've been having a blast with that game. It really is a lot of fun, really making me think of the movies in a good way. And just it's a surprisingly just a really good game. It's got a lot more depth than I thought it would. I played quite a bit more Star Ocean 2 Second Story R. I'm loving that remake. I love the original. I would say that Star Ocean 2 remake is, it plays like I'm getting those nostalgic feelings that I remember having when I was younger playing the original PlayStation 1 version. And when I've gone back and played an emulated version of the PlayStation 1 version, and of course, it's a lot more archaic looking, but they've done an excellent job with their remake, although it's obviously more advanced graphics and it has voice acting and all that stuff, but they did it in such a way that it rekindled the feeling I had when I played the original release. So it's one of those things where it's like, it plays the way you remember it playing. Even though you know it looks better, it still feels like that's how it was back then. It's an excellent remake. If you have any nostalgia for that game, absolutely pick it up. If you're just a fan of console role-playing games, especially Japanese ones, Star Ocean 2 Remake is 100% worth your time. So definitely check it out. And of course, I was playing a lot of Super Mario RPG, with the remake having come out on this past Friday, and it is amazing. It, of course, it's a gorgeous remake of the Super Nintendo Classic, and this was a game I always wanted them to bring up onto the Nintendo Switch, whether via the Nintendo Switch Online Super Nintendo app or some other means. When they announced that they're doing a full-on remake of it, but keeping true to the game in every way, except for just a visual overhaul, I was super excited because I never completed that game back in the day. I only ever played it a little bit because that was around the time of new consoles coming around. That was one of the last Super Nintendo titles to be released. So excited to be able to dive into this game and really just complete it. And I've played through quite a bit of it so far. It is not a terribly long game, but it is also, it's not like it's ultra short, but it is a very fun game. These mechanics are awesome. I love the interactive turn-based battle mechanics that, I mean, I don't know if any game did that before, but to my memory, this was the first game to sort of launch that style of button timing presses and stuff during the turn-based combat modes. And obviously that's a staple now in the Paper Mario and the Mario and Luigi series. So awesome stuff. If you're a fan and nostalgic for Super Mario RPG, this one absolutely hits the nail on the head. Okay, and the other game I wanted to mention that I was playing, which a game that I got from a pre-order that I put in before and I finally got around to playing, and that is Full Void, which is a release on the Evercade. So this is the first Evercade release that was a single game cartridge and is running natively on the cart too. So I am very impressed with this game. So I know this game did come out digitally for the Switch and there's a physical release of it on Evercade as well as a special edition, because I think they teamed up specifically with Evercade to have their native sort of version be for that platform, which was awesome, I thought. But the game is amazing. I'm almost completed. I'm very close to the end of the game. And so far, I'm very impressed with this game. And again, it's obviously with the retro aesthetic of Evercade. This game is very much like in the vein of a game like Flashback or Another World. So that style of physics-ish adventure game, very fun, and it's very imaginative. It's kind of like a story that's akin to Stranger Things done in an engine like that. It's a very fun game. I'm thinking I'm going to do an Evercade Expeditions episode sometime in the future featuring that game, because I was very surprised about it, and I'd like to talk more in depth about it eventually. But anyhow, that's it. I guess I can say as well that I dabbled a tiny bit with my time at Sandrock on the Switch, but you know, that game is an interesting game so far. I didn't really have enough time to figure it out. I just kind of played around with it a little bit and moved on to some other stuff. I'll probably dive into my time at Sandrock within the next couple months, just because I really like my time at Porsche. So assuming I'll feel the same way, this one seems to have been received pretty well, which is a good sign, I think. And actually, speaking of which, that reminds me, we need to talk about review culture. So let's take a quick break and come back for our segment. All right, thank you for waiting, and here we are. So, like I said, this episode is Crowing from the Perch, and it's going to be all about my take on review culture, basically. So you might have caught little hints of me talking about some review culture-ish stuff in the news today. For example, The Legend of Zelda movies, the reception that it's gotten. Just, you know, really, you listen to any episode, especially during the news segment, you'll probably hear bits about it. But basically, you know, this is something I've been thinking about for a while. You know, in recent months, it's been on my mind for a long time, but in recent months it's really been kind of pushed to the forefront. And with some of the stuff that's been going on, it seems to be coming to a head now. And, you know, I talked last week about the nominations for Game of the Year at the Game Awards. And you know what? There's a lot of that stuff. Just it all came to a head, and I decided, okay, I'm going to do that episode I've been thinking about for the last while. I'm going to do that for this one. And basically, I really want to talk about the negativity that seems to run rampant in review culture and some of the egos that get involved with it as well. So usually I try to keep things very positive, and I think my show's pretty positive in general. I mean, I like to talk about things that I like. So sometimes I might come off as a shill for some companies, I guess, but I'm not too concerned about that. Like, I just like to talk about things that I like to talk about. You know, and I guess this episode isn't exactly going to be super positive necessarily, but it's just more about like, hey, like if you're someone out there who's, you know, you're looking at the big sites like, you know, IGN, GameSpot and these guys, and you sort of get those negative vibes sometimes from these places. Well, I do too. And I wanted to just talk a little bit about what I see. But yeah, so basically, you know, the games media, this is where we'll start because it's much bigger than just that. But let's start with the games media. So I'm finding that especially like because I listen to a lot of different podcasts from just run-of-the-mill content creators like myself or a lot of like of the big company ones, right? Like I like the IGN ones. I used to listen to Kinda Funny, but that just wasn't for me anymore. I find Kinda Funny was a little more about the personalities as opposed to the games. And I don't know. I just find that the common thread through a lot of these, and it varies from company to company, is that the complaining nature that they have. A lot of them are always disappointed with things. They focus so much on the negative. And like I said, particularly the big sites. So I'm going to focus mostly right now on the big ones like GameSpot, Kotaku, and these guys. Kotaku's almost always publishing articles that are complaining and just being negative, just to the point where I just don't even visit them anymore because there's it always seemed to be rolling my eyes every time I go there. GameSpot is kind of is a little more negative too. IGN can be negative, although I do find that they are a little more excited about video games as well. But you listen to the discourse of some of their podcasts. And I'm primarily going to think about IGN here because those are the last of the big media ones that I really listen to. Sometimes, I don't know, some of them you just feel like they don't even like games. Like they love to really just tear games down, I think. Not all the time, but it's just really weird. So one thing that we've heard talked about in all these different video game websites is that there's a lot of talk about 2023 being one of the best years in gaming. And you know what? That's not necessarily untrue. I mean, it's true. Tons of major games have come out that are spectacular, right? Obviously. So, and this is definitely going to be a hallmark year remembered for generations to come, certainly. But I think when we talk about this kind of stuff, I always find that like there's always a theme that runs through the commentary that goes through all these different websites. And they're always focused around these review scores and particularly Metacritic averages. So it's even to the point in the modern day where some game companies will give their staff bonuses based entirely on the Metacritic ratings that they managed to obtain, which to me that's kind of crazy. On one hand, okay, I guess you can equate that with being increased potential for sales with better Metacritic ratings. But I don't know. It seems pretty wild to me that can happen. And the reason is that some of these sites revel in being sort of negative, basically, or bucking against certain things based on certain biases, right? So another thing, too, is that sometimes review scores for certain big tentpole titles seem to have some kind of coordination amongst the big places. So I guess I'll say right up front, one of them got caught kind of red-handed, and that was GameSpot back in the day when they fired Jeff Gerstmann when he had given the video game Kane and Lynch a bad review and not very flattering language used. And I don't mean cuss words or anything. It was just described as being a really ugly game, and these were not inaccurate descriptions either, but he really didn't like it. However, at the same time, GameSpot was also running a promotion with the game Kane and Lynch, and their borders of their website were all decorated in Kane and Lynch buy now. Meanwhile, the review was like, this game's awful. He got fired shortly after that, and then after that, a whole bunch of the staff there all just up and left because they were outraged on how that happened. That was kind of like the death of the integrity. So I always feel like I cannot take that site seriously anymore. Just because they openly broke that piece of integrity. And even, hey, listen, there's a whole bunch of new staff there now. Maybe it's all different. I don't know. But integrity matters here. And like now we see this kind of permeates through the review culture of the industry. Let's talk about modern day. So obviously Cayman Lynch was a long time ago, but let's talk about some of the reviews from this year. Because sometimes it seems like they kind of discuss about the themes they're going to really focus on and the ratings they're going to give to certain games. So let's talk about some of the hot button things that have come up over the past year. These are just minor examples of a bigger picture here, but I think maybe you'll get the idea from what I'm talking about. So let's look at Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3. I noted it in one of my last episodes that the single player campaign was getting a review, and it was getting a 4 out of 10 at IGN, which was a pretty big deal. And, you know, that was seemed kind of surprising to me, but then a whole bunch of other sites came out with very similar comments and very similar ratings. And I kept thinking, well, you know what, I haven't played it yet. And if they're all seeing the same thing, then it would stand to reason that maybe it's not very good. But when I actually got to play the campaign, granted, it's not like a masterpiece, although I would not describe any Call of Duty campaign to be like that. And I don't mean that as an insult to those games, because really I don't think most campaigns of any game are really that great, because to me video games, they don't really always specialize. The story can be good, but that's not really what you often go to for a game. But regardless, the storyline as it is in Call of Duty, I think is good. I think it's pretty good. I like how they tried something different with the mission types. I understand that, apparently, from what I understand in the news, that they were under duress to try and get the campaign done quick. And I think they did a great job. It was a lot of fun. And I agree that the more forced mission types were better. And the open mission types could be a little more difficult or a little more clunky sometimes. But listen, I didn't find it to be nearly that bad. I was very surprised at those low, low review scores. But I'll say this, is that the other thing too is that the multiplayer mode has its own separate review. It also got really bad. And I think the multiplayer has been great in this game. So I'm not sure what the change is there. But now the zombies mode is getting a review. And then I'm like, you know what? I know they always do this with Call of Duty, but it seems just ridiculous to me that they are reviewing it and assigning three different scores to it. It's like, what? No other game has ever afforded this kind of a situation. For example, let's say Mortal Kombat 1 just came out recently, right? Did its multiplayer get a separate review? No. Did a single player story get a separate review? They're completely different modes. No, it did not. What about the invasion mode? Did that get it? No, none of it. It just got one review score at the end. And actually, I think that one review score is that's the way it should be. Because really what's happening is the video game that the potential customer is going to buy costs one price. You pay this. Yes, there might be DLC or microtransactions that you could potentially partake in. But really, for the base game itself, including all the modes, it's in that one core price. In Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3, it's the same idea. You can spend the core price and get all those modes, and it's being rated differently. Now, obviously, they're rating it like that because Call of Duty drives a lot of traffic, and this will keep those clicks alive, which equals revenue for them. Now, why no one else has afforded that? To me, that's kind of like, is there some kind of journalistic integrity? Like, why is the tentpole, the yearly Call of Duty game, given this consideration, these three review scores, when just as easily any other game could? It's because it's more effort for them to produce that content, and they're only going to want to present the content that is actually going to drive traffic, right? So, I don't know. It seems dumb to me that that's the case. And also the fact that everyone seemed to be on the same page with it. And like I said, I'm playing through it myself, and I'm not seeing what the big issue was. There's something else that, to be honest, I'm not really sure what it is, but they're really ragging on Modern Warfare 3 for some reason, and now they're dressing all the news stories about it was such a rushed development. And, you know, I don't know enough detail about it, so I can't really say otherwise. But what I do know is that the end product, I think, is a strong product. And I'm happy with it. I think it's a lot of fun, if you like Call of Duty. But I don't know. It seemed weird that it gets that. So another thing, Lord of the Rings Gollum and Kong Rise of Skull Island. If you are familiar with these games at all, then you might know these are both the lowest reviewed games of the year. And the way that they get treated, and I'm not saying that, oh, they should be given better reviews or anything like that, but the way they kind of treat these as punchlines, to me, I don't know. It's one thing to say, hey, here's some bad reviews, but they kind of make them into sideshow attractions. And then just having them as the butt of jokes. But why? So Lord of the Rings particularly, but also Kong Rise of Skull Island, why are these not given the whole, I don't know, stretched out disdain that Call of Duty gets? I mean, Lord of the Rings is a well-loved license, and for them to take a character as beloved as Gollum and turn in a game that apparently is just completely drivel. Now, it certainly does not look good. I'm not at all interested in this game, regardless if it got a 10 out of 10 or 0 out of 10. It doesn't look very good. But I think it got a 4. Whatever. Either way, it got comparable scores to the campaign mode of Call of Duty, Modern Warfare 3. And again, this seems to be another sort of let's all check each other's math and make sure we're all kind of on the same page. At least that's the way it feels when you see these games. But the way those ones are just kind of tossed in as a joke, I don't know. It's just they celebrate this negativity. They just, I don't know. It just seems like they really revel in having these negative reviews like that. Now, but it's not all about the negative reviews. Of course, an age-old thing about reviews have been that sometimes some of these games, the ones that are coming up with amazing scores, sometimes in the perception is that some of these games have had their scores decided prior to people actually playing the game. So the two pretty big examples this year, I will say, and I can say, okay, let's just say it. So Spider-Man 2 is the most recent example of a game that I already knew coming out. This is going to score extremely high because it's the big Sony flagship, and it's Spider-Man and blah, 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 blah. The reviewers are going to eat it up like crazy. And I suspect it's also going to be very much the same game as the first one with a couple of tweaks. And that was correct. Not that I think that it deserves really low scores or anything like that, but I do feel like that was just pre-decided that they were going to... A lot of these positives that people noted about Spider-Man 2 were repeated across the board. For example, one of the big strengths, oh, you can fast travel and it's really quick. It's just, that's a weird, super strong point for a review and one that people have focused on quite a bit. Another one, and this one is funny because I do agree with the ratings it got, but that is Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom. You knew right off the top, this is going to get a super high review because of the prestige Breath of Wild had, as well as the prestige of Nintendo and the Legend of Zelda franchise. So now I do happen to agree that it is an amazing game, but again, I'm speaking sort of from someone who's maybe not into that stuff. They could probably guess that, of course, Zelda is going to get an amazing review. And it did. So like I said, review culture, it kind of follows these just these weird rules. It's changing all the time based on what's going on, but I just don't think that these reviews are adding a lot of value at the end of the day. It's really just, I don't know, it just reveling in just whatever the trending topic is, basically, and getting those clicks, I guess. That's the kind of the cynical way to put it, I guess. But yeah, it's something doesn't seem right about it. It's something I find distasteful about it, to be quite honest, at the end of the day. I do think IGN, I think as far as the big ones go, IGN, I think, is probably the most level-headed, I'll say. They are usually the ones who will buck against some of the trends. I remember back in the PS3 when the game Lair came out, and it was entirely reliant on the motion controls and the PS3 controller, and I guess there it was not very responsive. And some places were giving it high reviews, then IGN's review came out 4 out of 10. It's just not fun. The controller just never works. And it was actually a really good, well-thought-out review by Greg Miller, I think, at the time. But, I mean, they can fall as victims just as well as everyone else can to that sort of weird way of doing things. But that kind of brings me to another trend that kind of comes about with these games media people, and that is the clickbait dissenter. So I mentioned Zelda. So when Breath of the Wild came out, it was getting 10 out of 10, 10 out of 10, 100%, 100%, 100%, 9 out of 10, whatever, like all over the place. But, and obviously all the big outlets gave it huge ratings. Its Metacritic score was super high. But then you had one or two people who, for my money, didn't really have any good rationale as to a lower score, but coming in, it felt very much like they are looking to just upset the apple cart and drop that Metacritic score down by a little bit because their count on Metascore was weighted a little heavier than any old average Joe. So I'm obviously thinking about Jim Sterling's review of Breath of the Wild. It just kind of seemed out of spite a little bit. But, you know, whatever. Maybe Jim didn't care for Breath of the Wild. But either way, I don't know. Breath of the Wild definitely drew some attention like that. And the same thing with Tears of the Kingdom, I think, also drew some people who just wanted to, let's keep the ground level. And I think, like I said, these are clickbait dissenters because anyone giving it a low rating at the time was going to get a click from some of the people who are big-time defenders of Breath of the Wild, so they could contact that person and say, how dare you, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's pretty silly to do that. But either way, I think there are definitely people out there who are looking to just poke a stick into the beehive, essentially. And I don't know. It's just something that's just a reality of review culture today. And it's another thing that kind of takes the focus away on the actual games. Because I remember being young in playing video games, and you know, I've read Nintendo Power, which is really just sort of a glorified advertisement for Nintendo anyway, but and reading like Game Pro and all the different gaming magazines, Electronic Gaming Monthly, you know, loving the reviews that I read. And but you know what, like, it, they weren't the absolute word of law about whether or not I should buy a game. I appreciate to get these different viewpoints and stuff even today, but I find that sometimes I just won't read certain outlets because I can't stand there. They're trying to make it more about personality versus any actual meaningful content. And I don't know, it just feels like people are more excited to hate things and more excited to poke holes in things rather than just enjoy a game. It's one thing to be critical, but there's just not a lot of... I find that one thing lacking today in games media is there's a big time lack of integrity and a lack of consistency. And by consistency, I don't mean like from outlet to outlet. I mean, within one outlet in general, they won't always be consistent with themselves, right? Like I'm talking about that Modern Warfare 3 getting 3 review scores and just the way they present their negativity versus the Lord of the Rings Gollum and Rise of the Skull Island getting those review scores and being treated like this big funny joke. I don't know. Just nonsense. And, you know, this also trickles down to smaller content creators as well. Depending on who you follow, and I'm talking, these are like the little YouTubers, podcasters, and such like myself. But depending on who you follow, there's usually an adherence to, you know, Metacritic, OpenCritic, or you know, whatever of those aggregate websites that people follow, and the general quote-unquote accepted view of a game. So, for example, a movement online to not follow streamers who were playing Hogwarts Legacy, which came out earlier this year, despite the fact that Hogwarts Legacy was one of the best games released this year. Gorgeous visuals, amazing gameplay, incredible story, full-on top of the line production values, and sold through the roof. It's one of the highest selling games of the year. But there were people who were setting up accounts or tools that you could use to find out which streamers stream Hogwarts Legacy so you can ignore them. This was an act of destruction in the video game community, whether it's Hogwarts or something else, just because of some other issue outside of the actual game itself. Despite anything else, it just seems to be this real love to it's almost like a love to hate kind of situation. A lot of people just really love a good controversy, love to get things riled up. And I don't know, there's a real negativity that gets spread around a lot. I know sometimes that's just the nature of the internet, but I mean, you spend any time on a lot of video game discussion forums, like the message boards, like any of the big popular ones, and you'll see that there's a lot of people who are a lot of these forums are very focused on the quote unquote accepted view of a game. I remember when Fallout 76 came out and seeing it being trashed left, right, and center. And it's fine for people to not like something, even and to talk about it. But I remember being in a thread, which was the official topic thread about Fallout 76, and saying, hey, I'm liking it, wanting to engage my fellow fans. And I just got piled on about how awful the game was and how I couldn't possibly like it. And just it just crushed any kind of conversation you could have. And I mean, obviously, you know, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, etc. But I mean, I don't always just agree with it just because people feel that way in general. I liked it, and I still think Fallout 76 is great. And I mean, I think it's generally seen as actually a really good game now. But you know, a lot of people really didn't like it at the time. There's a lot of negativity that courses through, and it just seems to be that we've just kind of accepted it as the norm. And that just kind of sucks because it harms the community overall, these kinds of attitudes. But at the same time, there is definitely a good community out there still. It's just sometimes harder to find, I guess. And the last thing I want to talk about here before we get into the Game Awards is something that has come up, which kind of speaks to this, is there's been a lot of negativity towards Xbox this year, particularly. I mean, all three major platforms got some negativity, but Microsoft has had quite a bit. I mean, they've been in the news quite a bit for their acquisition of Activision Blizzard previously. And, you know, they had a couple of slip-ups through the year. So, yeah, there was definitely a lot of negativity there. But I find that there's kind of this excitement to report on bad news for Microsoft. And often it seems to be that there is a bit of a platform bias and preference against Microsoft and Xbox. And I've seen the term that's been trending lately is called the Xbox tax. And, you know, this seems to be, I saw the term, I'm like, what does that mean? Is it like, cause they used to say the Switch tax, where things would cost a little extra money on that platform. But in this case, I thought, are they saying Xbox is costing a little more money? What? I don't get it. And then I found out, oh, they mean games on Xbox, like especially first-party stuff, are not going to be taken as seriously as games on like PlayStation or Nintendo simply because it's Xbox. And, you know, at first I was like, well, that seems to be excessive. But the more I thought, I'm like, oh, that is kind of true. There is truth to that. And I don't think it's even something that we can really even deny anymore. And I think a lot of that is in the present day right now as a reaction due to Microsoft completing the transaction to buy Activision Blizzard, which a lot of people kind of felt like, oh, monopolization, blah, blah, blah. But, and I'm not saying yay or nay against that. I would, for one, was happy that they bought Activision Blizzard just because I think that they're going to open up the doors a little more for them to actually do some more stuff other than just Call of Duty. But also, I was also concerned that another group that would have more nefarious ideas in mind would have potentially bought them out, maybe like a Tencent or something like that. But when I really think about it, though, this is kind of similar to what Sony was doing back in the day when they were competing with Sega, since Nintendo didn't come out the door with their 64. Sony was out there acquiring studios. I mean, yeah, they didn't have what it took to acquire a publisher, but it is on the same level, acquiring exclusives. And I mean, they've continued to play from that playbook. So a lot of people complain that Xbox has been not able to, it's disappointed because they're not developing this talent inside, in-house. Instead, they're just buying stuff, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, that's what Sony did too. I think when we talk about, oh yeah, well, Sony today, they're developing all these internal studios, but it's because they originally purchased those studios and now they've had the time. And you're right, and that's just true. Now they've had the time to actually develop that talent. It takes time to get to that point. And Sony definitely was pinching out Sega at the time. I mean, there's a lot of different factors to why Sega left the hardware business, but that was part of it. And I think Microsoft buying Activision Blizzard is kind of a, is like a bigger, like the next level version of that, I guess, kind of happening in a modern day sort of scene. But anyway, that's something that's going on, and I think it's true. So you look at games that come out this year from their first-party studios, Redfall being the first major release for quite some time on there, getting just hammered. Now, granted, it's not exactly the best game of the world, but actually, I really like the game, and I think they've done a great job in delivering more for it to bring it up to that 60 frames per second promise that they had put out there. So it is a fun game, and I think, given the circumstances around Microsoft, had this been, let's say, for PlayStation, I know it was originally going to be released on PlayStation, but had it actually come out, I don't think it would have had as bad a reception. I think Microsoft, having bought Bethesda just the year before, had a lot to do with that. And then same thing with Starfall. Starfall had massive anticipation behind it, but it got tainted the moment it became a Microsoft exclusive. And I think that really helped to make this reception a little more lukewarm than I thought. It did get good reviews, though, at the end of the day. But, for example, I don't believe it would have had a 7 out of 10 on IGN had it been released as a multi-platform game. I think we would have seen probably an 8, maybe even a 9, quite possibly. I think it would have been more warmly received. And in actuality, that game is absolutely astounding. It is an incredible game. I played a ton of it, so that is something where I think, yes, the Xbox tax is in effect there. And even something like Forza Motorsport, that game came out. It got good reviews, but it didn't do as well as Turn 10 Studios titles usually do. So, again, I think that's the Xbox tax in effect there. And even something like Hi-Fi Rush being praised for how good it was, but a lot of it was a tone of surprise that an Xbox studio, you know, created this, but then a lot of, well, you know, it wasn't actually Xbox, they just bought it, and then a lot of like, oh, it's too bad that this is not coming out on PlayStation, which is fine to say that on the one end. If you're just a PlayStation owner, I can understand why you would want it on your platform too, for sure. But to sort of penalize something like that, I don't know, they seem to be a little more punitive in tone overall with Xbox titles. You know, just listen to the sentiment of most video game sites. You can definitely tell there is usually a bias, unless it's obviously if it's a Xbox specific site, then be a bias in the other way. Now, for me, I love all the platforms. I don't have any specific bias against any of them. I think they're all amazing. I'm lucky enough to have all of them, so I'm very. I think having all three of these companies be healthy is the best, because it forces them to compete well with one another. But we're at the end of the year now. That means it's time for the Game Awards. And of course, this is an area where the review culture is on display. And like I said last week, this week I'm going to go over all the reviews, nominations for the major video game awards nominations, and pick out the ones that I think are going to win. So the Game Awards are very similar to the Oscars in the way the Oscars are today. It's not always indicative of the actual vibe of how these games are for real, amongst real people. So the Game Awards measures the time period from December 1st of the prior year to the end of November of the current year. So this year is December 1st, 2022 through to the end of November 2023. Games released in that time will be considered for Game of the Year. And as with any award show, recency bias can be a thing, right? And that's just a realistic thing for any award show. And you can definitely see how review culture has impacted based on the nominations that have been released. For example, not a single nomination for Hogwarts Legacy in any of the categories, and there's several categories. It should have seen at least one nomination, but clearly they're trying to, I don't think it's necessarily malicious. I think they're trying to avoid any kind of potential, you know, controversy. I don't believe for a second that anyone legitimately believes Hogwarts Legacy didn't deserve any kind of a nomination for any of the categories, because obviously it did. There's just no denying that. And to me, that kind of speaks a bit to the nature of the Game Awards, and it's a bit of a disservice to the integrity of this particular award show. So the Xbox tax is also in effect here to a certain extent, not to the extent that you might that you would think based on the way it's been kind of going on social media. But, you know, as with everything you hear when something's being blown out of proportion online, there's extremes on one side and the other. Usually the truth lies somewhere in the middle, and I think that's the case here as well. And, you know, you can bet that throughout the themes that we see in the Game Awards and their nominations, you can bet that you're going to see a lot of those themes repeated from all the major outlets when they do their own Game of the Year awards later this year, like IGN and blah, 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 right? So it'll be interesting to see, but it's a pretty safe bet to know that those will be the themes. Now, there is a bit of a narrative out there as to who the potential running candidates are and who they're likely to be. And I do believe that those guesses or assumptions will likely prove to be correct in most of those situations. I mean, you know, it's important to remember at the end of the day, this is just really entertainment. I mean, award shows in general. And I'm really looking forward to watching it because it is also a celebration of video games as well. They do a lot of announcements at that show. But at the end, and, you know, it's fun and I'm glad it exists, but it's not really to be taken super seriously, to be quite honest. And with that, I'm going to go over some of the nominations. I'm going to tell you which ones that I believe will win, not based on what I want, but based on what I think will win. So these will not be nominations that I really want to win, but the winners that I think will happen will be based on what I think will win, some, you know, based somewhat on the review culture stuff that we've been talking about today, and just, you know, just the temperature in the room kind of stuff. So yeah, I mean, there's some awards categories here that I'm not really entirely sure what will happen with them, but some of them I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure this is probably going to be the winner. I'm going to do my best to try and accurately predict here. And I'll also give you a little bit of commentary as I go, kind of in the spirit of this segment's theme. And after the Game Awards show has aired on December 7th and is over and done with, the following episode, we will go over the winners there and see how accurate I was. See if I was right with my predictions or not. All right, so let's get right into it. And I'm going to start with the big one first, just to get it out of the way. Nominees at the Game Awards for Game of the Year were announced, and they include the following: Alan Wake 2, Baldur's Gate 3, Spider-Man 2, Resident Evil 4 Remake, Super Mario Bros. Wonder, and The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. All right, so just a quick thoughts here. Resident Evil 4, in my opinion, that shouldn't be nominated. That's a remake of a game. It shouldn't be Game of the Year, but I guess there's really no rules otherwise, but I think there could have been easily another game, like, you know, plenty of other games that could have been filled in here. There's obviously a lot of games that are missing from this list. And it's true that this was a very populated year with a lot of really huge games. So not everything is going to necessarily show up here, especially when they have a 6-game limit for this particular category. But Resident Evil 4, I don't know. I don't think so. But that's the one that seems like the glaring one that doesn't belong. Not to say anything bad about Resident Evil 4 Remake. I think it's incredible. It looks great, although I haven't really played through it much. But it is just a remake of the game, though. It's not... I don't think it should be up for Game of the Year just because it's the remake, but whatever. It is what it is. But I think the actual winner here, no doubt in my mind, will be Baldur's Gate 3. That seems to be the narrative out there. A lot of people think, oh, it's going to be Baldur's Gate. It's going to, you know, early in the year, a lot of Tears of the Kingdom, Baldur's Gate 3 is more recent, came out to massive acclaim, deservedly so. But this is one that I do believe will actually win Game of the Year. I think it's going to be Baldur's Gate 3. We've already seen early indication of this with the Golden Joysticks where it won, and I suspect that will be the case here. All right, so next up, Best Game Direction. So this I'm not 100% sure on because, you know, in the Oscars, when they do the Best Director nomination, usually whoever wins Best Director, the movie that they're being nominated or that they're winning for is usually going to be the Best Picture winner as well, although not always, but usually. So in this case, I don't know if that's going to be the case for Best video game direction, but we have nominees of Alan Wake 2, Baldur's Gate 3, Spider-Man 2, Super Mario Wonder, and Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. Which is going to get the best game direction? Well, it's this one's a little more difficult, but I'm going to go out on a limb here. This one, I have it narrowed down to a few that I think could be potential winners, but the one that I think will actually take it, and you know what, I'm going to go ahead and say that I think it's going to be Baldur's Gate 3. Again, because, yeah, I'm going to go based on the Oscars sort of idea that the best director often wins the best picture as well. So in this case, I'll say the same thing here. Baldur's Gate 3 takes best game direction as well as taking game of the year. All right, next one, best narrative. This is going to be nominees: Alan Wake 2, Baldur's Gate 3, Cyberpunk 2077, Phantom Liberty, Final Fantasy 16, and Marvel's Spider-Man 2. Well, that's quite the list of games. But interesting, I would say, that Phantom Liberty showing up, just because that's just an expansion. It's not a full game itself, but obviously a quality game nonetheless. The one that I think will win is going to be Baldur's Gate 3 again. I think that one is going to do a big cleanup of some of these big ones. So Baldur's Gate 3 is my pick for that one. All right, now the next one, best art direction. We have Alan Wake 2, Hi-Fi Rush. Very exciting to see that one. Lies of P, Super Mario Brothers Wonder, and Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. The one I think is going to take it here, and it's tough to say, but I think it's going to be Alan Wake 2. I think Alan Wake 2 walks away with best art direction. Best score and music. We have Alan Wake 2. They have all the composers' names, but I'm not going to be able to say all the names properly, so I'm going to not bother doing it. But Alan Wake 2, Baldur's Gate 3, Final Fantasy 16, Hi-Fi Rush, and The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom. Here, I think Hi-Fi Rush is going to win, simply because there's a lot of modern music songs that got turned into levels, and it was well done. So I think that this is where they're going to give Hi-Fi Rush some recognition. Hi-Fi Rush has a few nominations, and I think this is the area it's going to get it. All right, best audio design. That is Alan Wake 2, Dead Space, Hi-Fi Rush, Spider-Man 2, and Resident Evil 4. And in this case, Resident Evil 4, I think this is where they give it some love. Resident Evil 4 got a bunch of nominations, but this is the one I think it'll walk away with, because I feel like, well, they have to give it to something to it, because they kind of went all in here, and I think Resident Evil 4 is the way they're going to go there. All right, best performance. Ben Starr in Final Fantasy 16, Cameron Monaghan in Star Wars Jedi Survivor, Idris Elba, Cyberpunk 2077 Phantom Liberty, Melanie Libbard, Alan Wake 2, and Neil Newborn for Baldur's Gate 3. This one, Idris Elba, I think, wins, because Idris Elba is the most recognizable name on there, I think, unless I'm just out of touch with some of the other actors. But Idris Elba is a genuine movie star, and I think, yeah, they're going to want to give it to him. So he's going to be the one who walks away with that. All right, best ongoing game. This is a weird one. Okay, Apex Legends, Cyberpunk 2077, Final Fantasy 14, Fortnite, and Genshin Impact. So this one's weird because Cyberpunk got nominated, and it's the one that doesn't belong here because Apex, Final Fantasy 14, Fortnite, and Genshin Impact are all live service games, or in the case of Final Fantasy 14, an MMO. So they are, by their very nature, ongoing games that are constantly being updated for perpetuity, essentially, until such a time their user base drops off completely and then they shut the games down. Cyberpunk, however, is an offline single-player game. I don't know why it's getting best ongoing here, because it doesn't fit there at all. And actually, it's for that fact that I think they're going to give the award to that game, because there was a lot of narrative this year, but Cyberpunk, it really revived itself because it was so bad before. This, again, going back to my talk about narrative, when Cyberpunk 2077 came out, it did have some poor performance on the last gen machines, but this whole song and dance of how awful Cyberpunk was. And funny enough, a lot of them jumped the gun at first and gave it 9 and 10 out of 10 when it first came out, because that was the predetermined review scores provided. But after the big time backlash from the public, they all reverted. They went back and said, oh, here's a revised review, or here's a review of the last gen machines, which they weren't going to do. You know that, right? So now, because it is, and it was an amazing game from day one, in my opinion, I loved it, but it wasn't deserving of the controversy. But, you know, the review culture loves the controversy. And I think now that, because it is legitimately an amazing game and they patched it up, it looks great, it plays great, and everyone's now think, okay, now it's okay to like it. So it's gotten a lot of love this year, and especially with a solid expansion pack. However, it's not an ongoing game. It's not a live service game. This is just the base game plus the expansion pack. And I think they're going to give the award to that one, which is silly. But yeah, fair, whatever. You know, like I said, not to be taken seriously. Just kind of funny that that got put in there. Okay, best community support. So this one's also kind of funny. Baldur's Gate 3 nominated. So Cyberpunk 2077, Destiny 2, Final Fantasy 14, No Man's Sky. So these are all suitable games to be nominated, but the funny part is Destiny 2. And it's not funny, it's kind of sad, because the community support team for Destiny 2, a lot of them got laid off very recently because of trouble with Bungie, with diminishing income that Bungie is having with its Destiny 2 not being well received with the recent expansion and some of the changes they've made. So it would be kind of a dramatic twist if Destiny 2 were to win best community support, but in reality I think this one is going to go to Baldur's Gate 3. So there you go, Baldur's Gate 3 I think will get best community support. All right, best independent game, another controversial one, which I'll tell you in a second why. Nominees: Cocoon, Dave the Diver, Dredge, Sea of Stars, and Viewfinder. I've played everything here except for Viewfinder. Now, what I think will win? Sea of Stars. What makes it controversial is that Dave the Diver got nominated. Although at first blush, may seem appropriate because it has the look of it, but as it turns out, Dave the Diver is not an indie game. It was actually made by a full-on studio, like a full publisher. It was not independently released whatsoever, but here it is in the best indie game nomination. I think because of the controversy around this one now, I think Dave the Diver could have won this one. It probably would have. It's because it has the aesthetic. It looks like it's an indie game, but it's not. And I think because of that, they're not going to give it to Dave the Diver, and they're going to give it to Sea of Stars. Sea of Stars, of course, being a huge indie darling relatively recently, back in August when that one came out. It was a pretty big deal, made some waves there. So I think Sea of Stars walks away with it now. Okay, the best debut indie game, and that is Cocoon, Dredge, Pizza Tower, Vemba, and Viewfinder. So, again, Viewfinder, I know nothing about. I have not played Vemba, and the other three, I'm at least familiar with Vemba, and I know the other ones, and I think Venba's going to win here, and it's going to be controversial, but I do believe it's going to be completely based on just because of diversity reasons, I think. This is why Vemba's going to win. I believe that will be the case, and that's why they're going to walk away with it. All right, the best virtual reality / alternate, or whatever, alternate reality, best VR / AR category: Gran Turismo 7, Horizon Call of the Mountain, Humanity, Resident Evil Village, the VR mode, and Synapse. The one I think is going to take this one is Gran Turismo 7, because that wound up being the one that people resonated so much with and described as being the seller for the PlayStation VR 2. To be fair, I don't know anything about Synapse, but everything else I played, I'm familiar with. And I think Gran Turismo 7 is the one that walks away with it. Best action game: Armored Core 6, Fires of Rubicon, Dead Island 2, Ghost Runner 2, Hi-Fi Rush, and Remnant 2. I think Armored Core 6 is the one that walks away here. This is a FromSoft game, and they're a bit of a darling with the critics here, and I think that is going to be what nabs them this award. Best Action-Adventure Game, Alan Wake 2, Marvel's Spider-Man 2, Resident Evil 4, Star Wars Jedi Survivor, and Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. And in this case, I think Tears of the Kingdom is going to walk away with this one. I think this is where they reward Zelda, which if it had not been for Baldur's Gate, Zelda probably would have been the winner for Game of the Year. So I think this is where it gets rewarded now. All right, best role-playing game, Baldur's Gate 3, Final Fantasy 16, Lies of P, Sea of Stars, and Starfield. The only nomination for Starfield, I might add, for this one. So again, here's your Xbox tax in effect. But the winner in this one, I think, is absolutely going to be Baldur's Gate 3. It's going to win Game of the Year. It'd be kind of weird if they didn't give it Best RPG. It's basically going to clean up very well in most of the categories. All right, Best Fighting Game, God of Rock, Mortal Kombat 1, Nickelodeon All-Stars Brawl 2, Pocket Bravery, Street Fighter 6. Now, I'm not familiar with God of Rock or Pocket Bravery, but that doesn't matter. I think Street Fighter 6 is easily going to walk away with this. I think just it's just going to be the one that wins, I think. Okay, Best Family Game, Disney's Illusion Island, Party Animals, Pikmin 4, Sonic Superstars, and Super Mario Bros. Wonder. Clearly, I think Super Mario Bros. Wonder is the one that's going to win this one. Hands down, no questions asked. Best Sim Strategy, Advance Wars 1 and 2 Reboot Camp, City Skylines 2, Company Heroes 3, Fire Emblem Engage, and Pikmin 4. To be honest, I really don't know which one's going to win this one. So I just picked Fire Emblem Engage. Although, I guess when I think about it, that's kind of unlikely because it was released in January, so long ago. I think I've noticed a lot of people saying, hey, I keep forgetting Fire Emblem came out this year. And it's true, and it was really good. But I think Fire Emblem Engage could win. I guess it could be Pikmin 4 as well. But let's go ahead and just say Fire Emblem Engage. That's where I'm putting my money. Just kind of, you know, hey, it's a good game. I didn't play Company Heroes 3. City Skylines 2 I've not played either. I've played the previous entries in those franchises, so whatever. And yeah, I think Fire Emblem Engage will win. All right, Best Sports and Racing, EA Sports FC 24, F1 23, Forza Motorsport, Hot Wheels Unleashed 2 Turbocharged, and the Crew Motorfest. I think in this one, Forza Motorsport has to be the winner here. I think that'll be the winner. Mostly a lot of racing games, and actually it is all racing games except for EA Sports FC. So yeah, Forza is going to be the one that wins because I can't imagine they want to give EA yearly release an award. And the other two are a little more arcadey. I think Forza Motorsport is the one that wins here. All right, Best Multiplayer, Baldur's Gate 3, Diablo 4, Party Animals, Street Fighter 6, Super Mario Bros. Wonder. I think it's going to be Baldur's Gate 3 again. Best Adaptation. So this is an adaptation of a video game into another format. So Castlevania Nocturne, which is an animated movie, Gran Turismo, the movie, The Last of Us, the HBO TV series, the Super Mario Bros. Movie, and Twisted Metal, the HBO series. The winner here, I think, is absolutely going to be The Last of Us, the HBO series. It was a huge critical acclaim. So I think that immediately wins it the award. And I know that the Game Awards previously really loved everything Last of Us. So I think that will be no different here. Okay, and my last game that I'm going to comment, or last category that I'll comment on, is the most anticipated game, which is a game coming next year or later. And those ones are Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, Hades 2, Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth, Star Wars Outlaws, and Tekken 8. And again, hands down, the answer is going to be Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, because lots of excitement. It's imminent, too. It's coming in February. And I would also say, too, that none of the other ones have the same level of excitement, I would say, as Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. So I think that is absolutely the one that's going to win. Now, there was also a bunch of other esports nominations and Content Creator of the Year and stuff like that. But I really don't have any idea about any of those categories. And I'm not at all familiar with any of the content creators that they nominated for that category. So any guess I have there would be just 100%. Randomly picking a name, so I didn't bother commenting on those ones here. I do follow a lot of content creators, mind you, like I said, like on Rumble, on YouTube, etc., but no one I know is nominated for any of those things, so whatever. But yeah, those are my guesses. Let's see after the December 7th airing of the Game Awards, let's see how correct or off base I was with those predictions. So we'll see. So yeah. Well, as you know, I've been doing my retroactive Game of the Year segments since I started the show, doing Games of the Year from all the years past since I started playing video games, trying to catch up to present day. But I will be doing a Red Rooster full Game Awards show for 2023 in January. My period of quote-unquote eligibility is going to be January 1st through to December 31st, so I won't do an award show until the year is completed, and yeah, sometime in January you can look for that. It'll be a full show with the several categories, not just the Game of the Year. So yeah, it should be fun to go through that. You know, I know most places will be having theirs all done up by the end of December. Most game sites and companies finish those up right away. But I don't know. I like to make sure I give everything a fair chance, at least of the ones that interest me. And so I won't be doing it in time with everyone else, but that's just the time frame I prefer. So yeah, but yeah, that's everything. So a bit of rambly rant today about game review culture. Future episodes, of course, will be focusing more back onto the positive stuff. I just wanted to sort of talk about some of that today. So what are your thoughts? Do you agree with me? Did I say anything completely that you think I have completely wrong? Maybe I'm just a little bit jaded after all the different outlets that I've read and just maybe got a little fed up with it. I don't know. Give me your thoughts. Let me know what you think. You can reach out to me at redroostersgamingcoop@gmail.com, and I'd love to hear from you. So just reach out to me with any questions, if you just want to chat video games at all, feel free to reach out. Okay? But that's everything. So thank you very much for your time today. Have yourself a great day.